It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, August the 12th, 1974. It's a Monday afternoon out here. A lot has happened this week in the news pertaining to my research and work. I put things in a box every week, Mark KLRB, as the news falls, and decide what to share with you these 45 minutes. And last night I spread things across the top of a bed and a desk, and we could be going an hour a day for a month. Everything came down not fast enough, but fairly fast. The king is out. King Richard is out. The regal image of the monarch is gone, and he's replaced with the admiral. And we now have the Pentagon, and the admiral is a president. The Defense Intelligence Agency can safely run the White House. It will be infiltrated with members of the Pentagon as staff directing their selected agent, known as President Ford. I'm not going into a lot of thoughts that I had this week. I promised people on the telephone I'd share with them, but I want to just say that Richard Nixon was consistent to the very end, if nothing else. The Monday of this week, he signed a weapons bill for $22.2 billion of military procurement, and he had a $1 billion ceiling of military aid to South Vietnam, which for all practical purposes has been going into corruption, dictatorship, torture, and exploitation. And the same time, the afternoon, Thursday afternoon, before he left office and resigned August the 8th, 1974, he turned down, vetoed a bill of $13.6 billion that would be funds for farm programs, funds for food stamps, for rural sewers, environmental programs, and consumer protections. It all was vetoed. The money goes to weapons, and everything that goes towards a betterment of society is turned down. And if you think that's bad, wait till you see Gerald Ford's record, which we won't run down today. Roy Ash of the Office of Management Budget, a man I keep hammering at, revealed that the firm that he worked for, Litton Industries, is behind in their contracts for those ships that they're making, five amphibious assault ships, each one costing $153 to $228 million. His overruns, he said, despite severe shortages of manpower and shipbuilding, he's delayed. His cost overruns on these terrible submarines, his five ships, are $100 million per ship. And then I read my local papers, the Chronicle and the San Jose Mercury, and a few offices that mismanaged some food stamps or welfare programs in the terms of $60 or $600. The whole place is closed up because they mismanaged some piddly little dollars. But Litton Industries had a cost overrun and increased their outlay this year. It says $228.2 million and $1 million per ship. They're a little behind the time, a slowdown, and the taxpayer keeps funding. So true to his stature consistently against the people, also was vetoed the legal aid program for the poor to stop law schools that are in, quotes, antisocial agitation. That means helping people who are innocent get out of jail or prepare legal briefs for these people. So Mr. Nixon has gone out in grand style, and he's consistent. At least we can say that about him. For sure, he's consistent, and that is what was on his desk the day he left office with his sad maudlin speech downstairs to the help. I gave the name of a gentleman in New York who has a bibliography list, which is terribly important, and I got a lot of calls this week about it. Send a quarter or so to this gentleman and ask for his organizational list or his bibliography list. His name is Lindsay Auden, LINDSAYAUDIN, Lindsay Auden, 169 Main Street, Ossining, New York, OSSINING, New York, 10562. And he has 32 organizations or newsletters that are of tremendous value to people who want to see where I'm getting sources of my information. And I'll announce his address for about 5 weeks on the radio, and then I will indicate what some of these places mean, which ones to subscribe to, which are important. You can pick out some. He gives a description of the areas of concentration of each organization that's doing research or work. But it's important to send for this list because there's a wealth of information from 32 different organizations that are trying to alert people to what is happening in this country. And I received a lot of mail this week, about 40 letters for copies of The Realist and for bibliographies. If you write to KLRB, I forget to announce it at the end of the show, so I'm announcing it at the beginning, box 3904. And if you send $2, I'll send you the last three articles I've done. The new one comes out this week. The new Realist article will be out Thursday. You can enclose an extra 50 cents if you want. And if you send self-addressed envelopes, I send free bibliographies of suggested reading, a good deal of books and magazines to get you to look up some information for yourself, not to believe the things I say, but to get you started on your own so that you have ammunition when you write to public officials to talk about situations coming down on us. There was an article in the paper this week by a Judge Leonard Friedman in Sacramento, California, who said our correctional system is a failure. And he asked for a master plan to change the correction system in California. He said a cog in the machinery of justice is the correctional institution. With their riots and bitterness, they are fundamental failures. He said Ronald Reagan wants to build more prisons to replace. It would be like remodeling an ancient leaky ship that should be replaced in toto. The prison system of California is based on a framework of myths. This is what Judge Leonard Friedman said. And he wanted a commission of laypersons and ex-convicts possibly to help get into some of the prison problems. And he suggested Assemblyman Walter Karabian, K-A-R-A-B-I-A-N, who's chairman of the Assembly Committee on Prison Reform in Sacramento. And I received many letters from people in the California prisons because the KLRB show reaches Soledad. The one from KZAP reaches Folsom and Vacaville and Tracy. The one on KPU in San Francisco is reaching San Quentin. And I come into the station, I received a beautiful letter from somebody at Folsom today who is jailed on a charge that he didn't commit. He's innocent of the charges. The man who did the particular robbery could step forward and has, but people say he's not believable. The taxpayer is paying to keep these particular people, many of them in prison, without understanding that they could be on the outside. People have confessed to the crime that they're serving the time for. And the inhuman factor and the waste factor is so great in not understanding the relationship of the prisoner to the guard, to his neighborhood, to the importance of family visits, the importance of seeing former prisoners that they're cut off from, new friends and buddies they make, the person-to-person contact with the community, the need for ombudsman. And I've saved over the last 2 years hundreds of letters from prisoners, and I receive many every week. And if you, listening in prison, want me to represent you on this commission as a lay person, I have written to Assemblyman Walter Karabian in Sacramento. And if you write up there and you say, I want Mae Bressel as a lay person on your committee, that she understands our problems or seems to speak up for us, and if you have confidence in me, instead of writing to me and telling me, write up to Walter Karabian and say, if you're going to have this two-year committee of persons investigating the California prisons, that you would like me to be on that committee if possible, and then I would like to go up to Sacramento and become part of restructuring what is a terrible system in California and see what I could do in something positive besides speaking on the radio about these things, bring these letters, bring these individual situations, total them up, which is what I've been doing, and see what we can do about the situation. So those of you who care about prisoners who are on the outside or those who are on the inside who care about themselves, if you think I can help you, write to Sacramento and let's see what we can do. Well, Richard Nixon went out of office with a bang this week, and the newspaper was filled with conversations of the White House tapes. They seemed to be the straw that broke the camel's back. From terms of my research, I'm going to read to you on the air. I'm sure you read it in the newspapers, but I want to analyze it closely because it has to do with my first article in The Realist. It has to do with my 10 years research. And it came out in the Oval Room conversations on June 23rd at 10:04 in the morning and also in the afternoon at 1:04. Now, the conversation has to do with the Bay of Pigs operation. And if you notice, it was just 4 days after the Watergate arrest, but Richard Nixon was not concerned about the gemstone papers or the entry into the Democratic headquarters. That wasn't his problem. He was worried about opening up the Bay of Pigs operation, which James McCord says in his book, The Piece of Tape, The Bay of Pigs, had already been written about many times. We knew that the gemstone papers, the entry into the Democratic headquarters, were burned. Howard Hunt's desk was opened up. Some of it was given to Patrick Gray, the acting head of the FBI, to burn. A moving van came and took away boxes of White House papers that belonged to the plumbers, and it was destroyed at a private home. Just drove up to the White House, was all removed. The committee reelect the president put their papers into shredders. Soap bars were burned. The important thing was the president of the United States wasn't concerned about the Democratic headquarters or the tapes or the gemstone papers or the entry. He was concerned about the Bay of Pigs operation. Why? Let me read you the conversation, and I think it's important. Mr. Haldeman, now, on the investigation, you know, the Democratic break-in, we're back in the problem area because the FBI is not under control, because Gray doesn't exactly know how to control it. And they have their investigation is now leading into some productive areas because they've been able to trace the money, not through the money itself, but through the bank sources and the banker, and it goes in some directions we don't want it to. And there's some things like an informant in the street of FBI to the FBI in Miami who was a photographer, who had a friend who's a photographer. And it's things like that that are filtering in. Mitchell came up with yesterday, and Dean analyzed it carefully and concludes and concurs with Mitchell's recommendation, the only way to solve this, and we're set up beautifully to do it. Ah, and that's the only network that paid any attention to it last night was NBC. It was a massive story on the Cuban thing. Now, he says Gray isn't set up to handle this. Gray doesn't know exactly how to control this. The investigation is getting out of hand. Well, Patrick Gray belonged to the National Security Council. He was acting head of the FBI. He had covered the investigation of the ITT. He had covered an investigation of the Teamsters links and to Las Vegas and an investigation that was going on at that time. He had covered the Wallace shooting, the Arthur Brammer thing. Covered means put the lid on it so that the truth didn't come out. He covered an investigation in California of the provocateur planned Isla Vista riots, and he covered the murder of Ruben Salazar. So he was every bit their man. I have a record of 7 major cases that Patrick Gray from the Justice Department and the FBI put the lid on. So why wasn't he able to handle this? Well, in a conversation in McCord's book, he mentions a conversation between Patrick Gray and Dean at this particular time. And Dean assures Patrick Gray that they have to cover this up. He tells them they have to cover it up. And he says, who in the FBI is going to cover it for us? And Patrick Gray, he didn't use the words, who's going to cover it for us. He says, who's in the FBI looking it up? And the answer was Charles Bates of the FBI. Now, that's an important answer because Charles Bates is going to come out to California and be the agent in residence that sits in the home of Randolph Hearst every night and covers the fact of the CIA-FBI operation on the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. Charles Bates was removed from Washington, D.C., where he was the FBI investigator for the Watergate affair, and then he is to move to California to handle the Hearst case, which I said was planned in 1970 and was already set to go before the Watergate ever took place. Now, back to the White House tapes at 10:04 on June 23rd in the Oval Office. Haldeman says, now the way to handle this is for us to have Walters of the CIA call Patrick Gray, that's of the FBI, and say, stay the hell out of this. This is business we don't want you to go any further on. That's not an unusual development, and that would take care of that. And the president says, what about Pat Gray? You mean Pat Gray doesn't want to do this? Haldeman, Pat does want to. He does know how to, and he doesn't have any basis for doing it. Given this, he will have the basis. He'll call Mark Felt in, and Mark Felt is an FBI official in the high ones under Hoover. And then the two of them. Mark Felt wants to cooperate because he's ambitious. Now, you see how the White House, the president, and his most closest advisor feel about the FBI. The FBI will cover up an investigation if a man is ambitious. I wonder if the tapes show how ambitious Charlie Bates was to move to California for the next order. So they're going to ask the CIA to cover the Cuban. Now, the conversation goes on. The president, this is the CIA. They've traced the money. Who'd they trace it to? Haldeman, well, they traced it to a name, but they haven't gotten to the guy yet. It's Ken Dahlberg. Haldeman says, it's directly traceable. President, well, I mean, there's no way. I was just thinking, if they don't cooperate, what do they say? That they were approached by the Cubans. They'll say they were approached by the Cubans. That's what Dahlberg has to say, and the Texans have to say that too. Haldeman, well, if they will, but then we're really relying on more and more people all the time. That's the problem. They'll stop if we could take the other route. President, all right. Haldeman, and you seem to think that you can get them to stop? President, right, fine. Haldeman, they say the only way to do it is from the White House instructions. It's got to be Helms. And what's his name? Walters? Walters. And the proposal is for John Ehrlichman to call in Patrick Gray, to call Mr. Walters, and then they would say that the CIA has ordered the FBI not to go into the Cuban connection, the Bay of Pigs affair, you see. The president says, all right, fine. How do you call him in? I mean, you just say, well, we protected Richard Helms from one hell of a lot of things. And then they say, that's what Ehrlichman should say. So you see the double barrel here, the way I talk about political assassinations or conspiracies. You see the language, we'll get Mr. Felt of the FBI. He can cover this up because he's ambitious. So you work your way up if you cover conspiracies. And this is the team that was involved from the Bay of Pigs right up to through the Kennedy assassination, the Chappaquiddick, the Wallace, the Martin Luther King, all of the things I've been saying on these programs for 3 years and been writing about. But you take a man in quotes, he's ambitious, or you take Helms, we protected him. Since when does the President of the United States, the Justice Department, have to protect Richard Helms? We know what they've all done. They rub each other's back, they scratch each other's back, they protect one from prosecution investigation, they promote another, and the whole dirty team that's all still in power except for Nixon, who's out, is operating. Now, the president says, of course, this hunt, that will uncover a lot of things. You open the scab. There's a hell of a lot of things. We feel it would be very detrimental to have this thing to go any further. That involves these Cubans and Hunt and a lot of hanky-panky. And we have nothing, it has nothing to do with ourselves. And, well, what the hell? Did John Mitchell know about this? Now, you see, they're talking about the Cuban things. They're not talking about the Watergate at all. They're talking about the scabs. A hell of a lot of things that Helms knows, and they're going to use the Cubans to cover it. They talk again about the Bay of Pigs. Haldeman says, hell, yes, Mitchell, we can hit on any time we get a chance. We've got a reason for doing it, for going to them. President, when you get in, in unintelligible, people say, look, the problem is that they will open up the whole Bay of Pigs thing, and the president just feels that, without going into details, don't list them to the extent to say there's no involvement. Just say this is a comedy of errors without getting into it. The president believes it's going to open up the whole Bay of Pigs thing up again. And because these people are plugging for unintelligible, and they should call the FBI and unintelligible, don't go into this case further, period. That's the president, if you can understand that language. Don't go into it, period. Now, it's 11 o'clock, and at 1 o'clock, they've gone for their lunch. By then, it's 11:39. Here's their next meeting on June the 23rd. Oval Office, Mr. Haldeman, 104 to 113. This is a meeting that took 9 minutes, I guess. President, okay, just postpone. Unintelligible. Just say, unintelligible. Very bad to have that fellow E. Howard Hunt. Ah, he knows too damn much, and if he's involved, you happen to know that? If we get out this thing's involved, the Cuba thing, it would be a fiasco. It would make Hunt look, it would make the CIA look bad. It's going to make Hunt look bad. It's likely to blow the whole Bay of Pigs thing, which we think would be bad for the country at this time and for American foreign policy. Just say to lay off. Tell them to lay off. Don't you? The president, don't you? He tells them to lay off. What was bad for the country? What is going to blow? Again, let me remind you, they're not talking about entering the Democratic headquarters. This immediately after the arrests, a few days after the arrest, after the Gemstone files are burned, the Hunt tapes are gone. What's in his desk is opened up. Some is gone home with Patrick Gray. Some is in a van that's going to be burned. Some was to be deep sixed in the water, told to be drowned. James McCord's his typewriter ribbons have been burned. Everything's been scrambled at the CIA office. But this is what he says. It would make the CIA look bad. It's going to make Hunt look bad and likely to blow open the whole Bay of Pigs thing, which we think would be bad for the country at this time and American foreign policy. Tell him to lay off. Haldeman, yep, that's the basis to do it. Just leave it at that. President, I don't know if you'll get any ideas for doing it because our concern, political, unintelligible. Helms is not one to unintelligible. I would just say, look it, because of the Hunt involvement, whole cover, basically this. Haldeman, yep, good move. Well, E. Howard Hunt was the case officer at Mexico City when Lee Harvey Oswald was at Mexico City, and the men that worked with E. Howard Hunt had all worked in the Bay of Pigs operation that were involved in the Watergate. And the arrangement of Clay Shaw down in Mexico City was related to E. Howard Hunt. But the President of the United States is saying America can't handle this at this time. It's bad for the country. And Haldeman, yep, that's the basis to do it. Just leave it at that. Okay. Haldeman says, I think Helms did too. Unintelligible. Said, I have no blank space. President, God, unintelligible. Haldeman, Gray called and said yesterday and said he thought unintelligible. President, who did? Gray? Haldeman, Gray called Helms and said, I think we've run into the middle of a CIA covert operation. Gray said that? The president says, yeah, and unintelligible. Said nothing, we've done at this point, and unintelligible. Says, well, it sure looks to me like it is blank, unintelligible. And that was the end of that conversation. Unintelligible. To the problem, it tracks back to the Bay of Pigs, and it tracks back to some other. The leads run out to people who had no involvement in this except by contacts and connections. But it gets the areas that are liable to be raised with a question mark. The whole problem, unintelligible Hunt. So at that point, he kind of got the picture. He said, we'll be very happy to be helpful. Unintelligible. Handle anything you want. I would like to know the reason for being helpful. I made it clear to him he wasn't going to get explicit, unintelligible, generality, and he said fine. And Walters, unintelligible. Walters is going to make a call to Gray. That's the way we put it, and that's the way we left. President, how does that work, though? They've got to unintelligible somebody from the Miami Bank. This is Haldeman, unintelligible. The point John makes, the Bureau is going on this because they don't know what they're uncovering. Unintelligible. Continue to pursue it. They don't need to because they already have their charge as far as the charges of these men. Unintelligible as they pursue it. Unintelligible. Exactly what we didn't in any way we saw, we unintelligible. One thing Helms did raise. He said Gray, he asked Gray why they thought they had a run into a CIA thing. And Gray said because of the characters involved and the amount of money involved and a lot of dough, unintelligible and unintelligible. Well, if you can make any sense out of that, let's turn to the realist. This was June 23rd conversation and I was already starting my article in The Realist for 4 days called Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? And I just want to read about 3 sentences of this because at the same time that I was writing this article, in Carmel, California. That conversation was taking place at the Oval Office of the President of the United States. And in my article, I said the Watergate affair is too large for the Democratic Party to prosecute or investigate. The best objective minds, not like the hand-picked Warren Commission, must work together and follow the pieces of tape left in the door latch of the Watergate Hotel that led to the arrest and continue to open more and more doors. And in the article, I said all of the five men caught in the headquarters were connected with the CIA in some way, and the other relationship they had in common was they worked together for the CIA plan Bay of Pigs invasion. In the article on page 33, I said there is no way to know what capacity Howard Hunt was serving in the CIA when John Kennedy was killed, when Robert Kennedy was killed, when Martin Luther King was murdered, when Ted Kennedy's car was pushed into Chappaquiddick, when Diem was removed by our CIA by a coup d'etat. This is from The Realist. All the elements necessary for this Squad 19 were assembled. Five men skilled in cloak and dagger intelligence operations, all with CIA experience, veterans of the Bay of Pigs together, heavily and secretly financed, connect to military troops waiting for direct combat against radicals and left-wing groups, were all dining together and living at the Watergate Hotel at the time they were arrested in one bag. And then the article goes on, how do you recognize that CIA espionage plot? But at the time that I was writing that they were all cloak and daggers from the Bay of Pigs, they were all working for the CIA, they were heavily financed. I went ahead and wrote my article, and Patrick Gray was saying, this was in June 23rd, Gray was saying it was a CIA thing because of the characters involved, the amount of money involved, a lot of dough, and a lot of his unintelligibles. Well, I asked in that article 2 years ago, where was E. Howard Hunt when all this was taking place? Now we know that E. Howard Hunt was a case officer in Mexico City at the time Lee Harvey Oswald was assigned down there for his visit for several days. E. Howard Hunt and the plumbers were involved, Mr. Laswitz, in the Chappaquiddick affair, which will be coming out in the next year or so. Hunt was involved, and Laswitz, in the Wallace shooting, the Arthur Bremer and George Wallace in May of 72, that affair. Hunt was forging the documents that John Kennedy murdered Diem in the White House just at the time I was writing the article and asking the question, and we know the involvement of the CIA in overthrowing Greece, which is coming out every day more and more now that they are removing these people from their country, hopefully. So I posed the question, where was E. Howard Hunt in those days? And other people in the last 2 years have put it together. Well, so much for that. I'd like to reread it. I should just spend the next 15 minutes rereading that. It's a classic, but you can look up your newspapers. It was the June 23rd conversation in the Oval Office. And the important thing to remember is that what the president held back the last and finally resigned about, the tapes he turned over, the thing that was the turning point, were conversations that had nothing to do with the Watergate Hotel. They had to do with the Bay of Pigs operation and his team that all worked together from that day on. And that's what he was afraid about, and that's what he was covering up. Well, President Ford, Saturday, the headlines of this week, August the 10th, President Ford says the nightmare is over. He pledges openness, honesty, candor in his administration. Whose nightmare is it? Is it Richard Nixon's? Is it Patrick Gray? Is it John Mitchell? Is it E. Howard Hunt or James McCord? Is the secrecy over? How can you have openness, honesty, and candor when that gentleman was on the Warren Commission and served to cover up the assassination of a president of the United States? Is he lying one more time? How can we believe a word that he's saying unless he gets into this investigation? And who is the nightmare over for? I did one show here of 23 people that have died just related to the Watergate affair. President Ford says the nightmare is over. I hope his nightmare is just beginning. If you heard the news this evening, the news service carried the story of his being at the Warren Commission, the very first meeting when evidence came that Lee Harvey Oswald was an agent of the FBI, which in fact he was, and also of Navy intelligence, and Gerald Ford had to know that. It didn't take me more than 3 months research, again, out in Carmel, reading the witness testimony to figure that out. And he heard direct testimony and evidence, which was later squashed. Well, the news of this week, I'm going to cover news pertaining to political assassinations, because Gerald Ford is our president now, and we have to continue to investigate these things, our nightmare of having murders or assassins or cover-ups running our government, will continue until we clean these people out, including the president, if he doesn't cooperate. I received a letter from Henry B. Gonzalez, congressman, and he thanked me for my letter. He's interested in reopening the study of President John Kennedy's death, and he said, "You're most kind to share with me some of the findings of your 10 years of research. I hope most sincerely it would be possible to get Congress to consider opening the investigation." But he said, "You know, of course, unless there's a large amount of congressmen sincerely interested, our efforts will be in vain. So please be sure to communicate with your own congressmen and with others with whom you might have some influence." He said if he ever got out to California soon, he would look at my research and files. He appreciated the letter. So it's up to you who are listening to the program to write to your congressman, anyone that you believe in or like from any state, and tell them that you support the movement of Henry B. Gonzalez to open up the Kennedy assassination. The format of Dialogue Conspiracy always was to take the news of the week and show how it pertains to the past political assassinations, because there was so much news coming in every week over the past 3 years. But when the Watergate took place 2 years ago, the immediate shock of the men being arrested there and the news took a lot of our program time, although I did keep up with my listeners all the information on the various assassinations. But I want you to know that every day major information is coming out to open up the story of who killed John Kennedy, or on the James Ray shooting Martin Luther King. And I'll just give you some examples of what's in the news this week. And this is why you cannot sit back and depend upon the Pentagon or Gerald Ford to take care of your best interests. You should push for these examinations to be open, because there's many, many researchers around the country working. One of them is Dr. Cyril Weck. You know his name. He's a forensic pathologist, a coroner from Pittsburgh, and a lawyer who finally got into the National Archives after 7 years of research and request to get in there, and discovered that the slides, the sections of Kennedy's brain were missing that would indicate that there was more than one gun shooting President Kennedy. If the chemical substances were different in different areas or parts of the body, it would indicate that there were two weapons. And now in a magazine called Forensic Science Magazine, Dr. Weck has said this month that there are at least two kinds of bullet directions that killed John Kennedy based upon his research. One gunman was on the low floor or the west end of the building, the Texas School Depository Building, another on the roof. The autopsy was grossly incomplete, he said. An Army general, and this is new information that came out this week, assumed complete charge of the autopsy. It was done at a Navy hospital. An Army general took complete charged the autopsy and ordered the doctors not to dissect certain wounds when the doctors wanted to recreate what happened during the assassination. Also that came out this week is information from Penn Jones Jr. from Texas, who's written 3 books on the Kennedy assassination, with information on a character known to the researchers as the Babushka Woman. We have certain code words like bullet 399, and one of the things is a Babushka Woman. This is a woman that you see in Life magazine or various articles and newspapers, who was at Dealey Plaza when John Kennedy was shot, and she was standing facing the school book depository and had a scarf, a triangle scarf, over her head. And it took many years to identify her. And this week, Penn Jones came out with the startling revelation of who she is. And now you can understand why it was so hard to find this woman, or why the FBI knew, interviewed her, but didn't write her up as a witness at the Warren Commission hearings. She had a camera with a zoom lens that was taken immediately after John Kennedy was killed. It was taken by an FBI man by the name of Regis Kennedy. I shouldn't say immediately. He went to where this particular woman worked, which was at the Colony Club. He knew where to find her. She worked next door to Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. She was married to an important crime syndicate figure in the area who was known for murders of killings her husband could and did kill many people in the Dallas area for organized crime. She claims that she and her husband had a two-hour conversation, a private conversation in Miami in 1968 with Richard Nixon at the time he was seeking the presidency. Her husband was killed 2 years later, gangland-style murder. She was a close friend of Jack Ruby's. Ruby had introduced her to Oswald, who had been in his nightclub many times at the Carousel Club next door, and he always introduced Oswald to her as Oswald of the CIA, which, again, the news tonight is just bringing out the point which has been mentioned through the years that Gerald Ford knew from the first meeting of the Warren Commission that Oswald was an agent of the FBI. He served both agencies. This woman saw David Ferry at the nightclub at Oswald with Jack Ruby's nightclub, the Carousel Club. He had been in there many times. This was the gentleman that passed away from a karate chop in New Orleans when Jim Garrison, the district attorney, wanted to arrest him in conjunction with the Kennedy assassination. He also was an agent of the CIA, as designated by Victor Marchetti in his new book, The Craft of Intelligence. The woman spent a lot of time in Jack Ruby's nightclub and next door at her own nightclub where she worked, and she also dated George Senator, Jack Ruby's roommate. A third revelation, which wasn't in the news media but will be surfacing one day soon, I hope, was it's based upon a call that I received. It's the third time I've heard from a certain party in Los Angeles that a man interested in revealing the facts about the John Kennedy assassination, he was one of the gunmen, may surface soon. The go-between me and this major character lives in Los Angeles. There are documentations in archives, or in safe deposit boxes, and the story of the confession. When I received the call, I asked about the gunman, because I knew there were three gunmen, and this party said, yes, that's right, you have it correctly, he's one of the three gunmen. Why would he surface at this time, or why would an intermediary reach me? One of the answers is that a lot of people are aware of how much research is linking the White House Watergate team to the Kennedy assassination or the other political assassinations, and they want to get protection from prosecution by naming the people higher up who hired them. A case will be heard pretty soon at the grand jury in Shell County, Tennessee, involving James Ray, the alleged assassin of Martin Luther King, who said there was a conspiracy and that he was a patsy for a long time, but was told by his lawyer to plead guilty or else he'd be barbecued and murdered. And James Ray is saying that he did not kill Martin Luther King, and he wants another trial. The Supreme Court turned down this request, but a grand jury is taking the information, and this is what they're going to be told. There are three witnesses that will appear before this grand jury. They were men who were involved, and three of them were paid $250,000 for the assassination of Martin Luther King. The triggerman received $100,000, and the two associates, $75,000 each. The three men are going to name four prominent American businessmen. James Ray was their patsy. He escaped from the Missouri prison April 23, 1967, and within the same summer, by August, he met a man named Raoul, R-A-O-U-L, also known as Jack Armstrong, who offered him money for running drugs from Canada to Mexico, and that was to be the cover for those months until the following April, a year later, when they brought James Ray to Birmingham and to Atlanta and Memphis, Tennessee. James Ray was in Birmingham, Alabama. He met Raoul there. He bought a white Mustang for James Ray, and he was told to purchase a high-powered rifle in Birmingham, which Ray took with him to Memphis. The gun was left in the boarding house as he was instructed. It had Ray's fingerprints on the rifle. Ray used the white Mustang for a getaway because Raoul ordered him to. He was down the street at the time of the shooting. Jumped back into his car. Raoul was in his car, covered with a blanket. James Ray ended up in London and then was brought home. And there were six witnesses at the time of Martin Luther King was killed who said they saw a triggerman down below at the Lorraine Motel, down on the street, not where the rooming house was that James Ray was alleged to have been in at the time. James Ray said in an interview in Look magazine right after the assassination of Martin Luther King that King had to be killed in an election year. You see, it was important to get the law and order vote, whip up the enthusiasm for a tough man already selected as a clandestine agent named Spiro Agnew, who in July down in Miami would take the nation by surprise. His only claim to fame, his big claim, was putting down the blacks at the time Martin Luther King was killed. That was his prominence, notoriety, and on those wings and the song and a promise, he became the vice president under the law and order ticket. I'm convinced that many of the riots in Newark and in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Los Angeles, Detroit, Maryland could be arranged by the same people that arranged riots in Chicago in 68 or were arranging the riots in Miami for the convention that was to take place in order to come down on the radicals. And the whole Watergate team was set up for this operation and to kidnap radicals and discredit the McGovern people and the Democratic Party. The same kind of riots were arranged in 1970 to discredit the blacks. Percy Foreman, the lawyer for James Ray, said that he handled the case. He only told him what he thought was best for him, that he'd be executed if he didn't work out a trade. The trade was lifetime in jail or be executed. And Percy Foreman was sent there. He said there would have been more profit in a book if a book came out on James Ray saying there was a conspiracy, but he passed it up and he took a plea of guilty. Well, Ray said there was a conspiracy and he wanted to talk, but the job of Percy Foreman as the attorney was not to make money off of Ray, but to keep him quiet. And that's why these alleged assassins have to have famous lawyers to come in. The men like, say, Lee Harvey Oswald, well, he only lived 2 days, but in the case of Sirhan Sirhan or James Earl Ray, they bring in prominent attorneys from the CIA who make sure that their client doesn't talk and that he gets isolated once he gets to prison. So Gerald Ford, as the new president, right from the Warren Commission 10 years ago, is going to have situations here like this case opening up. Wallace is saying that the money that was sent, $400,000 to defeat him, never was received in the hands of the persons that were supposed to get it. George Wallace says, I'm a victim of Watergate, and he announced that many people are now working on his case, which is the truth, and I hope that that opens up within the next months in a short time. I spoke 2 weeks ago of an article on the Ted Kennedy accident at Chappaquiddick, an article by Robert Sherrill in the New York Times, which begins with the statement, a car owned by Ted Kennedy went into the water. He never said Ted Kennedy drove the car. And Midnight Magazine, August 5th, comes out with an article by Dukes County Sheriff Christopher Look, who said, I know and he knows, meaning Ted Kennedy, someone is fabricating a story and I'm not the one. He said he saw the registration car, the license number of the car, and gave it to the medical examiner before the car ever got out of the water. And the sheriff said, I saw that car at 12:45 and there was a man in it. See, he spoke, the car pulled up to a curb and he went out to talk to them and they stepped on the gas. But he saw a man in there, he saw a woman there and another person in back. And he never said he saw Ted Kennedy in that car. So that case will be opening up. Well, it's important to know that one of the things that brought poor Richard down this week had a lot to do with using the CIA to cover up the investigation of the Watergate, but that they were really stopping was the truth of the chain of command of a group of clandestine agents that received their power illegally through conspiracies and assassinations. And one of the men important in covering it up is now the president of the United States. We have to be more alert than ever, keep our eyes open, write to congressmen, write to public officials, and make sure that these things don't continue indefinitely. We have to stop this process at some point and stop the assassins from running the nation. And if Gerald Ford's talking about truth and candor, this is the time to put him to a test and open up the new evidence, because goodness knows it exists. Well, that's it for tonight. I'll see you next Monday. Take care of everything, and we'll meet again Monday at KLRB at Dialogue Conspiracy.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB FM in Carmel, California.